This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we're talking with another candidate. We have asked a number of candidates who are running in areas that overlap with our coverage area to come and be on the program to give voters an opportunity to talk with them. As reporters and interviewers, we talk to these people all the time. We have pretty regular access. But this idea here is that voters, if there's a particular issue that concerns you, this is your opportunity to call and talk directly with the candidate. And our guest is Todd Satterthwaite. He's a Democratic candidate for the Illinois House in the 103rd District. His opponent, by the way, is the incumbent here in that district, Rick Winkle, Republican. He will be on the show this week also at 10 o'clock on Thursday. So you'll have the opportunity to hear from both of them and talk with both of them. So if you'd like to talk with Todd Satterthwaite, call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. I'm not sure that would be a long-distance call with any time place within the 103rd, but anyway, I'll give it. That's 800-222-WILL, so you can call in and talk with us. And also, I guess we should mention in terms of background, Todd Satterthwaite is the mayor of Urbana. He was first elected in April of 1993 and then was reelected in 1997. He's also been involved in business in Urbana for a number of years, and going back to the early 90s, he served in the Peace Corps from April of 1990 to May of 1992. He grew up here in the area, went to the University of Illinois, and graduated from University High School. And we're glad to have him here. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure, David.
There are a number of things that I know that I can ask you about, and again, we'll hope that there are some people who are listening will want to ask questions, too. Let's talk about education and state support of education. It seems that now there are many candidates who are talking about the need for the state to supply a greater percentage of the funds that fund. And in here, we're talking about elementary, secondary education, not higher education.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you've said that you think that the state ought to get up to the 51% mark. It should at least be that much over half, and it's significantly less at this point. How though do you do that? How do you make that happen?
Well, I think you make it happen by making education a top priority. And one way that I think we ought to do it is to put the lion's share of any new revenue that the state gets into education. And there was a bill that failed in Springfield this last session that was called Fund Education First. Would have made it a law to do just that. And you think, well, half of the new revenue going to education, is that really enough? And, you know, it's significant in that the state's revenues have been growing at about 8 to 10% over the last few years. And so this is really a significant source of revenue. And I think you identified the problem very well. And I think it was back in the 70s, the state did fund education at nearly 50%. And then the other 50% was through local property taxes. But over the decades, the state has really not embraced its role as a primary funder of public education, and that percentage has dropped down to below 40%. And so I would like to see the state make education a top priority and fund more of the share of the cost of public education.
Now, well, I guess for a number of years now, people in the legislature, people in education have been talking about changing the way the public schools are funded. There are some people who believe that what we ought to do is move away from the property tax as the principal method and do something else. And I guess that means that what we would be doing would be a kind of a swap and say we're going to take the burden off property tax and, say, put it on income tax. And it has been discussed. Some people in the sort of policy community in the state have said they thought that it was a good idea. And there is even some people in the General Assembly who would have supported such a notion. But it was not successful, I think, mostly because Republicans in the collar counties didn't want to have anything to do with it. And it may be that other people would be reluctant to support that because it might look like the end result would be people paying more taxes.
Yeah.
What do you think about that idea?
Well, I think it's a good concept. Again, I think the state right now is in pretty good financial shape, so I don't think we need to raise more money, but the way we raise it could certainly be improved. And I've talked to a lot of people. You know, I've been going through the district for the last 6 months and talking to a lot of folks, both here in Champaign-Urbana and in the rural areas of the district, and there are a lot of people that are very unhappy about the reliance on a property tax for funding not just the local schools, but some of the other local government as well. And just because people have property doesn't mean they're making money. You get there are a lot of retired couples that have a home, they're on a fixed income, but yet they see their property tax going up. And it's, in my mind, a much fairer way to fund governmental services through an income tax. But again, I would support that as a swap, but not as some kind of a revenue generator. And I know some of the bills in the past have not only done the swap, but have increased revenue as well. So I would certainly be in favor of it. I think it's the income tax is a much fairer way to pay for governmental services than the local property tax.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this it's something particularly, I think, that is of interest to rural folks and farmers. And in a district like this, or once you get downstate, you're going to find a lot of people probably of both parties that would support that notion. Is there ever going to be enough support in the General Assembly, given the fact that people upstate seem not to care much for this idea, to actually have a change like that happen?
Well, I don't know. I understand that you know, some of the Republicans in the collar counties don't think that it's a very viable idea. I think they see the income tax, if there's more reliance on the income tax, they see more of Chicago area and collar county dollars going downstate. Mm-hmm. And so they see it as a downstate subsidy from their area. And certainly if we switch the method of funding, we have to make the formula of funding something that's fair so that everyone perceives the whole educational funding system as being fair, not only for their own school district, but for school districts throughout the state. But it's tough if, you know, any legislator that votes to send money from their district to another district is going to have a hard time when they face reelection. And I think that's part of the roadblock there.
Yeah.
So, but I think as, you know, and to illustrate what some of the inequities are right now, and some of the collar counties will spend, you know, $12,000 to $15,000 per student in those school districts, and the floor level set by the state now is something like $4,400. So they're spending like three times the amount in some of those school districts, and they feel that you know, their property tax goes for their local schools, and they want to maintain that high quality, and that if it's all funded by income tax, that they're going to take their income tax dollars, and the state's going to shift it to downstate school districts that are in a lot of trouble right now.
Well, I think that a few years ago, there certainly was recognition that there was a big gap between the most prosperous districts and the others that were on the bottom, and there was some effort to narrow that gap at least a little bit by raising the bottom level and saying that mm-hmm. at least this much should be spent. But even after that was done, there is still a big gap between the ones on the bottom and the most prosperous districts. Can the state do more, or should the state do more to equalize the amount of money that districts have to spend per pupil?
Yeah, I think so. I think that the floor level has been established, and I think we need to keep raising that so that we have that we can count on having good education throughout the entire state of Illinois, rather than having terrific education and you know, the best schools and the best teachers and best technology in some areas, and then other school districts that are barely getting by with crumbling schools. They don't have enough money to put computers and other internet technology in the schools and so forth. So we really need to have a system where every kid is going to have an opportunity to get a first-class education.
We're talking this morning in this hour, Focus 580, with Todd Satterthwaite. He's a Democratic candidate for the Illinois House in the 103rd District. He is running against the incumbent, Rick Winkle. Mr. Winkle will be here on the program later this week on Thursday. We'll do the same thing. This is your opportunity. If there are questions about, you know, issues that concern you, you can call and talk with the candidate. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Just staying with education for a little bit, nowadays, one of the big words that's on everybody's lips is accountability. I think that a lot of people, they feel that it's important to support the schools, but they also want to feel that the money is being well spent and that students are performing at the level we would like. The state now has a program of testing. They're testing students periodically through their school career in basic areas and things like math and science and so forth. And those kinds of results are made public so that at least you can look at how students in Illinois, how they're doing compared with where we, you know, where we think we would like them to be. In some areas, I think folks have been kind of disappointed that students, that Illinois students on the whole are not doing better. What do you think about this approach to, in a sense, grading schools and students and coming up with some way of answering that question, well, you know, how well are we doing?
Well, I think we need to have some system of benchmarks so that we can find out if our schools are doing the job that we expect of them. You know, I've talked to Dr. Zilima Harris out at Parkland, and she's, you know, the president there. And not only does she work with business people in trying to have curricula that will be tailored to their needs, but she's found that a lot of kids, when they come into Parkland, don't have the basic skills that they need. And she started working with some of the high schools throughout the district to say, this is the kind of skills and this is the kind of classwork that these students need to have before they even get to Parkland, so that they don't have to be teaching the kids the basics when they get to Parkland before they can teach them some other kind of work skill. So we need to have some benchmarks and show how people are, show how the students are doing. I think when you take it the next step and have those test scores determine how much state funding you're going to get, there you get into a real problem. Then if a school is falling down in, slightly in the scores, and just when they need the help the most, then you pull the help away from them. I think, you know, that's been done in some states, and I would certainly think that that's a dangerous trend around here. But we do need to have the accountability. One of the trends that I've been made aware of is the fact that there'll probably be a lot of teachers that are retiring in the next decade, and that it is increasingly difficult for school districts to get the best teachers and keep the best teachers. And so I would promote some programs where the state would give some subsidies or incentives to students that want to get into teaching as a profession so that we can make that a more attractive profession for young people to get into. And then create some programs that school districts can use to retain teachers as well by getting them some additional training and be able to teach them the newest up-to-date classroom procedures and so forth. Mm-hmm. So I think we can do a better job of recruiting and retaining teachers, and that's going to be something that's going to be a challenge for the entire state in the next several years.
Well, just going back for a second to the accountability issue, if you say that you don't want to make funding contingent on student performance, but you do want to hold the feet of school administrators to the fire somehow and say, well, we do expect that your students to perform at a student level, or even say to the student, we expect you to perform at a certain level. If they're not, then what do you do about that to try to get them to the level that you'd like them to be?
Well, I think then the state can send people in to work with the school district and say, you know, find out what the reason is. You know, is it because our students underperforming because there are other problems in the community? Maybe they're, you know, if it's been in an area where there's high unemployment, maybe the kids aren't getting the proper nutrition in the morning. You know, maybe there are other things that are going on. So I think, you know, there's no one cookie cutter solution. We should go in and find out what the problems are and give that particular school district the help that they need to be able to bring those student scores back up.
Let's turn to a different topic. I think that there are a lot of people who feel that this part of the state, this district, because of the presence of the University of Illinois, is positioned to be a great center of high-tech industry. And we certainly have seen some of that already with both in private business here and also the university moving to try to develop partnerships between the university and private business. And we've got high-tech incubators going up all over the place. Can the state do more to try to foster the growth of high-tech businesses in this community?
Well, I think we've got a great start with the two high-tech parks that are going on right now. And, you know, as Mayor of Urbana, I've been very intimately involved with the one that's, you know, right next to WILL here at the studios. And, you know, preparing the infrastructure and, you know, the enterprise zones and so forth that the business community needs. Exactly, you know, what more the state needs to do, I don't know. There's, you know, one of the real challenges I think that we could address and make ourselves more competitive with other university research parks, not only throughout the region, but throughout the country, because that's who we're competing with. I mean, we're not the only one with high-tech parks. In fact, we're kind of, you know, a little slower in developing our tech parks than a lot of other universities. And one problem that's been identified is that we're not keeping a lot of our engineering and computer science grads from the University of Illinois here in Illinois. Mm-hmm. And so I would like to explore the possibility of having an income tax credit for companies that employ University of Illinois graduates. And that way we can keep our good brain power here in the state of Illinois and provide an incentive for these high-tech companies to locate here, an incentive that they might not get anywhere else. And when these companies, you know, from my experience, they look at the entire package of, you know, how business is going to be done in the area. What are the property taxes? You know, how can I get the right kind of employees? Do you have the pool of talent that I need? Am I going to be able to get the utilities and all this kind of thing? And you know, if you throw a tax credit into the mix where they could be hiring U of I grads and using that for their talent pool, I think could be very attractive to some of these high-tech businesses.
I'd like to say again here on Focus 580, our guest in this part of the show is Todd Satterthwaite. He's a Democratic candidate for the Illinois House in the 103rd District. And again, if you have questions, specific things that you'd like to ask, pick up the telephone, give us a call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. I was looking over at your responses to a questionnaire that was sent out from the Chicago Tribune on various kinds of subjects from your website. And one of the things that it asked about was the tobacco settlement money. And you said that you think that the largest part of that money should go to whatever we can do to try to keep young people from smoking. And that has certainly not been the case with the way this money has been dispersed. The percentage of money that was going to prevention, to health care, and so forth is really quite small. And a goodly chunk of it actually went to provide tax relief to Illinoisans. I take it that you would not have supported that?
Well, I don't think that that's the right way to go about it. You're right. I would strongly support using the money in a way that we can address some of the problems, particularly that smoking causes in our society. And there's a bill sponsored by some of the Democrats, Representative Fritchie, that I would support. And what it does is have put money into smoking and tobacco control. It puts it into healthy communities, healthy schools. Those types of things, I think, are a more appropriate use of the money rather than giving some minor form of temporary tax relief. I think if we really go to the root of the problem and try to keep young people from smoking in the first place, then we're not going to have the huge health burden of treating them after they've been smokers for 30 or 40 or 50 years. And we all pay for that through the health insurance that we pay and through the costs that the state bears in some of the hospital bills.
Would you support using any of that money for non-smoking related sorts of purposes?
Well, yeah, I think other healthcare purposes. There's a proposal that would put some of this into health care at the schools and talk about, putting nurses back into some of the schools. And there are a lot of schools that have had to cut back as they've faced funding crunches, and they don't have qualified or trained nurses on the premises. And so one of the proposals is to fund a program where you could have somebody that is on school premises and helping young people out with their immediate health care needs. So it wouldn't be just tobacco related, but other health care needs identified throughout the state as well.
Mm. More in sort of exploring the area of health care a little bit more, there's something that you have also stressed your interest in, particularly trying to expand the kind of health care that's available to people who are on the two ends of the age spectrum, young people, old people. What is it that you would like to see happen?
Well, first on the younger end of the spectrum, the federal government gives the states money for health insurance, and the program in Illinois is called KidCare. And there are certain income levels, but families that are in those income levels can sign their kids up for health insurance for free. And but the fact is that there are a lot of families that qualify that don't know about the program. And a couple of years ago, we were unsuccessful in getting enough people on board and had to even turn back about $50 million to the federal government because it went unused. Well, we need to do a better job of doing outreach to the families that can qualify. And we don't have to look very far. I mean, there are other states that are getting this federal money, and they're doing a good job of outreach. One of the ideas that Indiana has for their program is to sign families and kids up when they enroll in school in the fall. And so rather than having the applications at some state office where a family has to go in, make a special trip, that those applications are right there where every family with kids has to register for school. So that's one way where you can get a much greater percentage of the families that qualify involved in the program. If there's money still left over from that, we can start to include some of the parents in these families in the health care coverage as well. Because what good does it do a kid if the parent is has a sickness or an illness that is going to be very costly and could financially cripple that family? Then the health and well-being of the kids is jeopardized as well. So there are ways that we can expand those programs and just use up some of the money that the federal government is giving to us in a grant.
On the other end, one of the big issues in the presidential campaign has been, should the federal government provide some coverage for prescription drugs for seniors? That's something that you've also talked about trying to do on the state level. How would that work?
Well, there's a bill that failed in the spring that's called the Senior Citizen Drug Discount Program. And what it would do is enable the state to buy prescription drugs in bulk and then pass the savings on to seniors. The problem is that there are a number of seniors that don't have any prescription drug coverage whatsoever. And I'm sure my opponent will tell you about the expansion of the Circuit Breaker program. Well, that's for low-income seniors, and there are certain income levels. If you don't meet those income guidelines, you don't get the benefits. And the statistics show that there are some 500,000 seniors without coverage whatsoever. And for them, if for a $25 annual fee, they could sign up for this program and get, like I said, anywhere from 35 to 50% off the cost of their prescription drugs. And I've talked to seniors throughout the district, and some of them are facing monthly bills and prescription drugs of $200, $300, $400 a month. And so a $25 annual fee could literally save them hundreds of dollars. And when they're on fixed incomes, it's something that's very significant to them. And I was surprised when I first started talking to seniors about the high cost of prescription drugs earlier this summer. I thought, well, some seniors are going to be affected. But virtually every senior knows about the high cost of prescription drugs, is taking some form of medication, or has a spouse that's taking a form of medication, or a friend. And it's something that every single senior recognizes as a problem. And so I think we need to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. And now, would the cost of the program be covered by the premiums that individuals would pay, or does this also mean that the state's going to have to kick in additional money?
No, the state should not have to kick in any additional money. The monthly or the annual fee should cover the administrative costs, and all the savings in the cost of the prescription drugs comes through the strength of bulk purchasing. It's the same kind of discount that pharmaceuticals give to HMOs and large corporations, so it's the same kind of concept.
Mm-hmm. Now, I suppose one concern that people might have would be that, for example, if you're in an HMO and you have some prescription drug coverage, they have an approved formulary. That is, there's a list of drugs that they cover. And then if there are other drugs that you decide or your doctor decides that you have to take, you may end up paying significantly more for that prescription. Is this going to be a thing where the state is going to have to get into deciding it's not that we're going to cover any prescription any doctor could write, but that it's only going to be a particular number of drugs? And, for example, if you have high blood pressure, we're going to say it'll cover these four, but these other drugs, no, we can't get into that.
No, that's how the circuit breaker works. And the circuit breaker covers prescription drugs for, I think, six different illnesses. Mm-hmm. And this program would cover any prescription drug. So there wouldn't be a determination of does this particular drug qualify or is it for an illness that qualifies or what have you. It would be for any prescription drug for that senior.
Mm-hmm. And how, and I guess I'm just, forgive me for just going on with this, but I'm just wondering how such a program would work. The person has the prescription, they go to the pharmacist, and who basically, where do they go to get their medication?
They would
who
go
handles
to the
paperwork, right, and so forth?
They would go to their pharmacist. The pharmacist would have to fill out the paperwork, but there's a program that already takes place through the circuit breaker. I mean, the state is giving prescription drug relief for some prescriptions through the circuit breaker, so it's very similar to the structure that's already set up for that. And so pharmacies participate. The senior would bring in their card that they get for paying their annual fee, and then they would pay the discount when they show that card at the pharmacy. And then the pharmacist and the state would take care of the other bookwork.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Todd Satterthwaite. He's running for the Illinois House in the 103rd District. He is a Democrat. His opponent is the incumbent, Republican Rick Winkle. He will be here on the program Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour to give you the same opportunity, but this is your shot at asking a question. If there's something that you'd want to call about, something that's important to you, do that. Pick up the telephone and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. I'll give the, just sort of out of habit here, I'll give the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. The one issue that's certainly been discussed quite a bit here in the last couple of years in the state of Illinois is capital punishment. There currently is a moratorium on executions that was put into place by the governor. His concern and others' concern is that we want to make certain that people have an adequate defense, and that if someone is convicted and sentenced to death, that we should be as sure as we can be that this person is actually guilty. And certainly we want those people to have the resources to mount some defense. Setting aside the whole question of the death penalty, I suppose some people would say, well, we should just get rid of it entirely. But if we're not going to do that, then what do you think should be done to the way that we try capital cases?
Well, I agree with some of the reforms that have been mentioned in making sure that anybody that is accused of a capital crime, that they would have the proper representation. I think part of these things goes back to, public defenders that have, maybe 1 year of experience or something like that are assigned these capital cases. So I think there ought to be some kind of standard for the type of representation that people who could be facing the death penalty should get. There needs to be some review, and I think that, that review needs to start now with the people that are on death row and make sure that they did get a fair trial, that they did have proper representation, that, all of the, you know, the whole trial was fair and that the representation was competent. And but I don't think that it's, you know, too much of a burden to be able to go back and check on those cases and make sure that the person did get the right kind of trial.
And what do you think about this idea that within various counties around the state, and I guess this would apply not only to the defense but also to the prosecution, if one or the other side lacks the resources to have forensic work done, have tests done, bring in expert witnesses, that the state will provide those resources. Do you think that that's an appropriate thing for the state to be doing?
Yeah, I think so. Some counties, you know, small counties may not have the resources to be able to do something like that. They're probably not going to be an inordinate number of these cases so that it would be a huge financial burden on the state. And I think that, you know, the need for a fair and just trial exceeds the cost that it would be inured to the state. So I think that the state should set aside a little bit of money for those counties that can't afford to provide the proper kind of representation and to foot the expenses for a fair trial.
Do you? What about the death penalty itself? Do you have strong feelings one way or another about the issue on that level, whether or not we should have it or not have it?
Well, I favor the death penalty. I know that there are certain crimes and certain people that have committed such heinous crimes that I don't believe they should ever be let free in society again. And so in those cases, I support the death penalty. On the other hand, I do support the governor's moratorium on executions in the state of Illinois until we make sure that everyone that's on death row has had a fair and competent trial.
Well, we have a caller here. A caller happens to be in Chicago, which we'll take. But I just want to invite people who live in the 103rd District, if you like to call and talk with our guest, Todd Satterthwaite, you can do that, 333-WILL or 9455. And we also have that toll-free line, 800-222-WILL. Here's a caller on our line number 4 in Chicago. Hello.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Good.
Good. I'd like to ask the candidate this two questions, really. You know, one is about the heinous crime. Should a crime necessarily has to be heinous in order for a person to, you know, be put to death? An innocent person's life is, to me, is as important as if the gruesomeness of a crime. You know, I think people sometimes react to a crime based upon that rather than taking the life of an innocent person. And my other question is about the tobacco settlement. He said that the young people should, that's where the money should have gone instead of giving it back to the citizens who were affected directly, you know, by the tobacco companies. It was not the young kids who were just born today, but the kids who are smoking today, because they've changed the way in which they do tobacco processing, I understand.
Well, to answer the tobacco question, I think that, you know, the state has paid a price for the cost of smoking illnesses or illnesses caused by smoking. And I think that as a society, if we want to reduce our overall costs, we should have programs where we keep people young and old from smoking. And most of the research shows that we'll have success in working with young people, because that's when people pick up the habit and continue it into their adult years. So I would be in favor of having some of the money targeted for smoking prevention, particularly for young people. As far as your other question about heinous, I guess it's just a difference of opinion on what the word heinous means. Any murder in my mind is heinous, and I guess some are more gruesome than others, but I don't you know, certainly think that any murder meets that definition.
Just I guess I want to make sure that we're clear upon what you said about using tobacco settlement money. As I heard it, you were saying education is important to try to keep young people from smoking, but also that we should be taking that money and also spending it on health programs generally, but also obviously to deal with the legacy of smoking. So we would be talking about the health of people perhaps who had been smoking for a long time.
Oh, absolutely.
In addition to the idea that we'd like kids also not to smoke.
Right, right. I mean, the plan that I support lists several areas. Smoking and tobacco control, healthy communities, seniors, healthy schools, health infrastructure. You know, so we're talking about a number of things, and a lot of them go for, you know, it runs the gamut anywhere from youth to seniors. So everyone would see some benefit from these programs.
Mm-hmm. Racial profiling, another issue that the Tribune in their survey asked you about, and people, I think, in many states are becoming more concerned about. And one of the basic questions people have is, well, does it happen or not, and how can we find out? And there are places where they what they require police to do is to keep track of the every time they stop somebody. And something about who that person is. So at least they can go back and say, okay, let's look at the number of stops and say, you know, how many people are African American? How many people are Asian American? How many people are Hispanic? So that you can at least get some sense of whether or not that's going on. What you, as I understand, you'd think that we should have, that we should be doing that in Illinois. We should be keeping track of that kind of information.
I think it's pretty easy to keep track of. In fact, in Urbana, we did something of this nature because, you know, we were asking the police officers. We'd seen, you know, the articles in other papers and magazines about profiling and just want to make darn sure that it's not happening here in Urbana. And so our police department crafted a very simple form. It wasn't on our regular report form, but crafted a very simple form that they could fill out in traffic stops that did not otherwise generate that information. And, you know, so we ran the numbers for several months just to make sure that none of our officers were profiling. And we know that this happens throughout the state, you know, and it may be more prevalent in some areas than others, and it may be more prevalent with a particular officer. And that's the whole idea. If you do find an officer that is profiling, then you can address the problem directly. And, you know, I know a lot of law enforcement officials, you know, think that, you know, one more form to fill out is one too many. But I think it's relatively simple and it's important enough so that we should address it.
So you would favor a law that would say for all law enforcement people in the state of Illinois, every time a stop is made, that information should be collected and recorded, and that information should be available.
Well, I don't know if we have the ability through a state law to do all that, but certainly for the Illinois State Police, when they're doing profiling or when they're doing traffic stops, that we can mandate it of them and make sure that no profiling is going on.
Mm-hmm. So, and you think that the state wouldn't have that authority for over municipal police departments?
Gosh, I'm not sure. I'd have to check on that.
Yeah, okay. We have a little bit less than 10 minutes left with Todd Satterthwaite. You have a question, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. One of the more controversial areas and one where I'm sure you and Mr. Winkle would have strong disagreements has to do with guns and laws on guns, how they should be regulated, the issue of safety, and so forth. What sort of laws applying to guns and their owners do you think we should have?
Well, this is an issue that I'm you know, very dedicated to, is increased gun safety. And I know the entire nation has been sensitized from, you know, headlines like Columbine to when we heard about the six-year-old up in Michigan bringing a gun to school and another six-year-old tragically killed. So I think there need to be some sensible gun storage laws that require gun owners in households where they're young people, where they're minors, to keep their guns stored safely. Now, that would be either with a trigger lock in a locked box, a locked cabinet, or someplace that's inaccessible to those young people. And statistics have shown that in areas that do this, that you get approximately a 25% drop in gun-related accidents for young people. And, you know, I think that it's essential that we have some common sense gun storage laws so that we can keep these guns out of kids' hands. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the statistics that just I was going through some of the material on this that was really striking to me is that there are 16,000 kids every year that are disciplined for bringing a gun to school. And it's no wonder that we have all these schoolyard shootings when there are that many kids bringing guns to school. And it's not just, you know, out of our area. I was looking through the newspapers, and in the last 2 or 3 years, there have been 5 instances right here in Champaign-Urbana where kids have brought guns to Champaign-Urbana schools. And we're just lucky that we haven't had a tragic accident with some of those incidents.
And that would be addressed by requiring people to keep their guns locked up?
That would be right. In households where there are children, keep those guns inaccessible. Either some gun owners break their gun down when it's stored at home. So if they're hunters, for instance, so that it's inoperable when it's at home. Others could have trigger locks. Others could have them locked in a cabinet or some other place that's inaccessible to children.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that some gun owners, and here I think we're kind of guns that we're really talking about is handguns. I don't know that we're really talking quite so much about long guns, rifles, and shotguns, although they may indeed be a problem. But that for people who have these kinds of guns, have handguns, many of them would say that the reason for having them is personal security. That is, that they feel the need to have that to protect their own safety. And when you're requiring them to keep a lock, either keep them in a locked box, keep a trigger lock on, or maybe you say that you should somehow keep the gun and the ammunition separate, that you're denying them the opportunity to exercise their right and use it for defense, which is the reason that they got it in the first place.
Well, it doesn't take very much to be able to enable a weapon if you've got it stored in a place where you know it is. It's relatively accessible to the adult that's responsible for it. I was talking to a gun owner the other day, and he was asking me about what I thought about gun safety. And when I told him about sensible gun safety in houses where there are kids, even though he's a gun owner and wanted his gun for exactly the purpose you're talking about, his own protection, he says that's a reasonable idea, a reasonable concept. And so even gun owners know that their responsible gun owners know that their weapons have to be stored safely in places where kids are around.
Try and get, we have a couple of callers here, at least one, if not both. Champaign is here, line number one. Hello. Is there a caller there on line one in Champaign?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, now. Yes, we can. Go ahead.
My question is whether or not the candidate supports hate crimes legislation, and if he does, how he can rationally make a distinction between dragging somebody behind a pickup truck because of their race as opposed to dragging someone behind a pickup truck because of their short, fat, rich, poor, male, female, or some other characteristic that wouldn't have to do with some of the protected classes of hate crimes legislation. And I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Well, I suppose hate crimes... Are something that do happen. Most of the time when it's a hate crime, it is because somebody is of a different color, sexual orientation, what have you. And I think it's generally pretty easy to tell whether it's a crime of hate or from some other reason. And so I do support hate crimes. But I think this goes back again to some of the sensible gun control issues. When we had this community was a victim of a hate crime when Benjamin Smith last 4th of July came through on a two-state shooting spree. And he didn't kill anyone in here, but it wasn't for lack of trying. He shot a student over on Goodwin Avenue in Urbana merely because of his race. And he got his gun not through a licensed dealer. In fact, he tried to get a gun through a licensed dealer and was turned down because of his background check. He had evidently had some kind of violent history. But he went to a gun show and was able to get the weapon that was used in his shooting spree at a gun show. And so we need to tighten up those gun show loopholes so that irresponsible people, people with uh, criminal backgrounds or possible mental histories that would make them dangerous, can't get these dangerous weapons. And I think that's something that's absolutely essential.
I think that for some people, the question is, they would say, well, if you commit assault, if you murder somebody, that's a crime. There is a penalty. If you're found guilty, you'll pay the penalty. You'll go to jail. You might even be put to death. What does it accomplish adding an extra penalty because of the ethnic background or the sexual orientation of the victim?
Well, I think that part of it is education, and there are some groups that just spout hate. And there's a question of whether when they're spouting this hate, they're also inciting people to cause these crimes. And I think if we have a definition of a hate crime, then we try to get to the cause, the root cause, which is some of these very prejudiced groups spewing hate and then almost inciting some of their members to go out and commit crimes. And I think that's the difference.
Well, at that point, I think we'll finish up for this time around. We want to say thanks very much to our guest, Todd Satterthwaite, for being
here. Okay. Well, thanks, David. It's been a pleasure being here.